This is Nathan Schwartz Salant, November 17th, 1989, Alchemy, Borderline States, Tape 1 of 3.
It is clear that at times I did distort what she said, as when I did not accurately hear and process her question concerning what should she do with her feelings when she felt no connection to me. When I insisted that only a change of form in the connection had occurred, I denied her perceptions and what she experienced, namely a space in which she had absolutely no link with me or with herself. After another session, feeling the stress of my work with her, I recorded the following imaginal process, my imagination. I want to thrash her, drown her in a stormy sea, throw her body to and fro in the waves until she will stop this torture of me with her withdrawals and masochism, leaving me always the guilty party. I feel the edges of losing the as if. Did I do it or didn't I? I then recognized that unconsciously, I may have felt this identification for some time, namely that I was her older brother, the one who had incestuously violated her. As a consequence of denying this level of psychotic countertransference, this level in which there was no as if, in which I touched a core of myself in which I was him, as a consequence of denying that, however, I had been forcing interpretations while trying to feel empathic and related to her, rather than feeling the air of unreality and disconnection which actually pervaded our work. Now, after these attempts at sorting out our process together, she asked the inevitable question, does this mean that I have been putting these reactions into you? Unfortunately for her, she's a therapist, you see, so she knows all these gimmicks. Therapists really can do a job on themselves. So she asked, does this mean that I have been putting these reactions into you? How easy it would have been to say yes. Clearly something like this had been going on. But I also felt that in becoming aware of the psychotic countertransference, I was opening up to a much larger realm that seemed to have a goal or a purpose. In other words, just touching that realm of awareness in which I believed I was her brother, I also touched a sense of a different scale, a different largeness of psyche in me that I knew was really at work in this process. Now, while the domain that I engaged with her surely included incest fantasies with my own mother and sister, the experience of a larger domain, an interactive field between us, and the sense that we were going through a process together, a process determined by this interactive field, offered a sense of meaning. This was no doubt an area in need of exploration, yet it soon began to feel too mental and non-substantial, and so I turned back to a projective identification, a developmental, historical view of parts I put into her and she into me, and in turn this felt too small, a killing of a realm of meaning, and in this way an emergence of the awareness of an oscillation between a personal, historical, and mythical, archetypal level resulted. This awareness had a changing form along lines of differing consciousness, mythical and historical. But what I want to emphasize is by interacting with my own psychotic countertransference, it was possible to actually penetrate a rhythmical field in which, on the one hand, an historical reconstruction made sense and then felt too constrictive and too small, and led to a larger sense of some mythical archetypal ordering going on. Not that it was clear what it was, but there was a larger kind of field ordering things, which in turn felt airy and heady and went back again to an historical reconstruction. And what I want to say to you is that it was possible to feel this as an inherent rhythm between us. Not something that I created, but I would say discovered as well as created with her. Our interaction could be understood as inclusive of some third thing, a mythical realm that had been ordering and weaving together the psychotic parts of our psyche. I'll stop and ask you something. You're a therapist, you're a patient. What goes on between the two of you? Is what you deal with a sum merely of the projections and counter-projections that you have? Your patient, if I may use this metaphor, has projections onto you. You have counter-projections in return. Is the stuff of your analysis those projections that you then order with reference to some developmental theory? Is that the stuff of what you deal with? Or, in fact, is there something else? Is there a kind of third realm? Is there a kind of third realm that is, in fact, normally unseen? A third realm that, in fact, can be opened to imagination, can at times be seen. The ancients called it the subtle body. An interactive field, I call it. A level that's beyond the normal space-time dimensions that we exist in. A level of reality that's always there, but often blocked to our awareness, blocked off to our awareness. Anybody a physicist here? Have you heard of hyperspace or string theory in physics? It's a wonderful kind of notion, a nice metaphor for this. The idea being that at the time of the Big Bang, the energies were so intense that in order to adequately understand them, one needed an 11-dimensional space. Then the world cooled off, the energies were not so hot, and 7 of those dimensions folded in out of sight, and one was just left with the 4-dimensional Einstein continuum. What happened to the other 7? Well, they've never been seen, but hyperspace has tremendous adherence among physicists because it's such a beautiful theory. Its beauty attracts people. One can play games and wonder if those 7 dimensions aren't the 7 dimensions that the mystic climbs through in his or her ascent. But whatever they may be, it's a nice model to fantasize, to wonder about in psychology, in our work with people, that there are other dimensions of reality. Now, of course, these are the dimensions of reality that people like Castaneda talked about when he talked about non-ordinary reality. Of course, these are these other dimensions of sight that the magical tradition, you know, engaged itself in. That every tradition, up to the last few hundred years, knew existed. It is possible to engage such a level with a patient. And in this particular case, as far as the archetypal component, I wondered if indeed such a level, a third realm, with its own energies and its own processes, not just a realm that is a nice kind of abstraction of the projections put into it by each person, but a realm with its own dynamics also. You see, like the ether in science once had, its own properties. Not just an empty thing, but something with its own properties, its own dynamics, that in fact such a dimension of existence could possibly exist. That I wondered about as I cast my eye towards the possibility of a larger third thing weaving our lives together. So to look more at what that third thing could be, to go back to alchemy, which knew about those third things, you see. Because that's what alchemy was concerned with, the subtle body, that realm of existence. That was the object of alchemy. Now, to consider this third realm, this possible mythical realm, we could look at the background of our psychotic episodes. They were always preceded by an unconscious union state, indicated by her dreams in which there was a marriage or a wedding. Then a devastating negredo would set in, a devastating darkness and disorientation would set in. I didn't recognize this at first, that these wedding dreams preceded these states. I only caught on after quite a while afterwards. For example, a wedding dream preceded the session in which I had insisted that we had a connection. I recognized that my periodically difficult times with this patient had always been preceded by such dreams. At this point, I could document three of her previous ones. Later, I recognized there were more. In this case, as a consequence of these experiences, which were traumatic for both of us, our negredo had, to use the alchemical metaphor, been found and contained. In this blackness, the unconscious incestuous couple, which dominated our interactive field, could be transformed and would eventually perhaps become a field of experience of subtle body or transitional phenomena. This is a quality of what the alchemists call the lapis, and Jung refers to a text which says, "The stone is in you, the stone is under you, and near you, and above you, and around you." And that's an exact metaphor that people sometimes use to describe Winnicottian transitional space. That's the stone they were after. That capacity to get into a realm, if you want to be a Winnicottian, in which one could play, in which play was possible. When you deal with psychotic parts, there is no capacity to play. There is only literalism. When you deal with split-off parts of psyche, it's very, very difficult to play. As you could see with this patient, there had been a total absence of play. So it would be kind of odd to say what the alchemists were after was play. But in a sense, it's true. The patient and I, at times at her urging, often went back to that fateful session in which I sought to deal with our relationship in terms of a sadomasochistic quality. I was perplexed at times and felt persecuted by her insistence that we still had unfinished business. Although by now I had learned to respect her reticence to go on as if we had cleared up what had occurred in that session. I've got about 15 more minutes. Do you want to sit more, or do you want to take a little break? Sit? Okay. Then we'll take a break, and then we'll go back and talk. Okay. Then another conjunctio dream occurred. There had been no conscious feeling of union between us preceding that dream, as can be the case when the conjunctio is felt in the here and now of analytic work. Instead, there was some sense of calmness, which was unusual, but that was all. That was the conscious symptom. But the dream of a marriage came. In the ensuing session, where she previously rebelled at my saying that she heard me say what I had said, now she was deeply upset at the content as well. She believed that I really felt she was a disgusting whore. I felt anxious now about her dropping more deeply into a psychotic state in which suicidal drives mounted from her despair over the loss of her capacity to think and from her fear that she would never emerge from this condition. I tended to recall to her at that time that I believed we were in tune together and that she understood that I was role-playing with her. It's embarrassing to recall it. And that I was not at all conscious of feeling that she was in any way disgusting. In fact, I had believed that a state that was totally the opposite prevailed. A state in which I felt a deep kinship with her, a common effect of the conjunctio. As if she was an intimately known sister with whom I had a right to say or feel whatever I chose. I only now learned that this was my belief and not shared by her at all. She felt no right at all, and if anything, totally in my power. She could sense, but only barely feel, a deep anger. Through these so-called kinship feelings, our psychotic parts were secretly running the show, and a sadomasochistic field was being acted out rather than enacted. So I had to ask myself, did I believe she was a disgusting whore? I had to recognize that in some place, in some way, I could say yes. For to the extent that I felt I was her brother in incest, I also experienced her as seducing me. Now, the imagery of the whore is abundant in alchemy. For example, in the Negredo, the dark side of the moon wounds the sun. Gradually, I was able to recognize that such imagery was also pertinent to my own psychotic sector. Structured by such mythical forms as the Near Eastern myth of Attis and Cybele. Attis is the sun lover of the Great Mother. Driven mad by his mother's insane love for him, and by his inability to free himself from his own passion for her, he is destroyed by a wild boar, or in many other versions, castrates himself under a pine tree. I share my relationship to such material in which, as Jung says, a man is only a dream of the mother, because I have seen its presence in so many analysts. It is acknowledged by some and denied by others. There's no man alive who does not have an intense issue of the son-lover archetype within him. It's a man's problem. Surely this son-lover archetype was a dominant factor of Jung's psyche, as can be seen in his work with Sabina Spielrein. I believe that this archetypal constellation, to one degree or another, exists as a dominant structure for anyone today, a result of patriarchal domination of thousands of years and reinforced by personal incest issues. Men have been conditioned to be narcissistically injured by its presence. When my normal ego state was strongly affected by this archetypal pattern, I felt in danger of being overwhelmed by the patient's needs and desires. I must emphasize the near total nature of this experience, in which engulfment and a loss of my autonomy felt very real. But through being able to imaginally relate to the presence of this archetypal sector and associated ego state, I could now begin to see my projection onto the patient, even though I had not consciously felt her to be seductive or dangerous. It was then clear to me that through the constellation of this archetypal pattern, I would see her as a whore and both hate her for the power she had over me, while desiring to fuse with her, to neutralize that power and regain a sense of safety. Unless I own levels in myself in which an Attis-like myth functioned, my patient would be left feeling delusional. Her imaginal perceptions, her real vision denied. When this was the case, she would have no clear idea of what was occurring between us. Instead, her vision would manifest through bodily pains and distress about that particular sadomasochistic session. It took considerable courage for her to contain her confusion and discomfort rather than disengage from her perception and become her compliant and competent self. For me, to understand this great danger for this patient, like many people suffering from a borderline condition, is that the person can split and become competent, can split and become rational and competent. That was the great danger. That would be a terrible regression. Jung talks about the negative restoration of the persona, for example. It's an example of it. For me, consciousness of this archetypal level and its overwhelming nature in me was the key to entering a heart-centered link with her which could perceive her process. Prompted by her concerns, which could so easily be reduced to her paranoia, I also had to recognize that I said what I did not merely as an actor in her drama. The qualities that often create the greatest difficulties in the analysis of the psychotic part are precisely those that go back to ancient substrata of the mind, such as the sun-lover mythology. Here we confront shadow qualities that are not capable of being integrated into the ego sphere, but instead must be seen, felt, and experienced as devotees of a god or goddess would experience the deity's rite. The scale of such phenomena is far larger than that of the ego. What is significant is the act of imaginally perceiving and experiencing them. And what I mean by that is an act in which, to take this case material as an example, I could experience within myself, imaginally, this sun-lover level, a hugeness of process and an ego state in which it could be overwhelmed, and feel it and speak in a way out of it. Not speak its language, but let it in a way be part of my perceptions as I was with her. So there was no power drive on my part to overwhelm it, but instead be aware of it, and in that way, I could speak through my heart. Because I was speaking from a place in which I was overwhelmed. You know, in the Middle Ages, the way that the devil was countered was with the cross, which meant to be aware of one's state of being overwhelmed by the demonic power while one was open to the faith in Christ. But it was the awareness of being overwhelmed that was the key to not being devoured by the power drive of the devil. It's the same way in dealing with these overwhelming, potentially demonic archetypal levels, demonic when they grab the ego, because then you will be the black magician, whether you think so or not. But to be aware of their existence as an autonomous quality within you, in turn, leads to an opening of the heart and the imagination. Because it's the opposite of a power drive. It's the awareness of totally, in fact, having been and being potentially capable of again being overwhelmed at any time. Returning now to my clinical material. Near the end of the 2-year span I have been covering, the patient's rage was now mobilized by what she perceived as my lack of connection to myself. This issue surfaced after yet another dream of a wedding, and this time we both wondered what would happen next. 2 weeks later, her rage came as never before, and with it intense despair and hatred of me for not letting her just die. She was filled with hatred for my faith in our process and for what she experienced as my torturing her with it. At this time, her madness emerged even more forcefully. I was anxious about a delusional transference occurring, for her madness did not have the form of a child part lost in overwhelming anxieties and rage, but felt like a mass of formless fury aimed at me. She then dreamed of an insurance man who was named Hinckley. He was the deranged would-be assassin of President Reagan. It became clear that her insurance against loss and abandonment was to come from being mad. You see, that madness can be an escape from pain, great escape from pain. The pain of loss of connection with me, however, was mounting to a new level of intensity. She felt she knew union with me and with herself at moments probably linked to her wedding dreams. But there was no continuity embodied sense of linking. A soulless state tortured her, and its lack of containment was at times very anxiety-provoking for me. Several months later, there was another dream of a wedding, and the resulting negreta was the most devastating yet. She spoke now of feeling totally dispensable. However, in spite of its intensity, and while suicidal thoughts and emotional isolation were still present, she was now far less schizoid. It was as if the young part of her that had, in fact, hidden as a child in hopes of not being found was now integrated into the analytic process. This new spiral downward contained the previous material we worked on, but included an important structural change as well. Feelings of withdrawal and unrelatedness still plagued her, but they were less intense and less so while she was with me. In other words, what began to come clear was that the states we had gone through, these states of unions, these resulting levels of negredo and madness, these psychotic levels of transference and countertransference, mysteriously had a goal. A goal. And the goal they seemed to be having was one of integrating the split-off schizoid part of her that had never previously been in the process. Started to integrate it in a coherent way, so there was a stability. This material is from 4 to 6 years of her work. Since then, there have been 2 more years, and I know this, in fact, to be absolutely the fact of what happened. In the next session, she said that during the previous session, she was different. When I told her that I felt her to be different now, introverted and reflective, rather than withdrawn, she responded by saying that she, too, noticed these changes. When she left my office, she said goodbye. Previously, she had said nothing for 6 years. She had just left. At the moment of her leaving, I felt that she finally was separating from me and feeling her own interiority rather than splitting off her affects. But quickly, this optimism gave way to another thought. What did she really mean by saying goodbye? Would she now kill herself? In fact, this stage in our work ushered in the patient's newfound capacity to consciously wrestle with whether she would live or die. Now, rather than a death urge rushing over her and fought back by her only with splitting defenses of a manic nature, she could actively face death. The renegade that lurks in suicidal drives became more visible to her, and the threatening vulnerability of embracing life became a pressing issue that challenged her courage. Just 2 more pages. As the patient gradually became more able to connect with her split-off soul, her withdrawal lessened, and a heart-centered imagination became possible. I was then able to feel an aliveness in my heart and less drive to enforce control and connection through knowledge or interpretation. This process is difficult to describe because it exists within an imaginal reality in which one's attention flows through the heart, and out towards another person. In the process, imaginal sight emerges, a quality of consciousness that perceives the presence of the archetypal level. This sight can be experienced through the eyes, the body, or through feeling. But it is a level of perception that gently penetrates in ways that a discursive process fails to achieve. To the abandoned soul, knowledge without heart feels like abandonment and rape. The heart offers a way to connect without violating the soul, and only the heart. The Negredo states that continue to emerge were difficult to manage, especially as they plunge the patient ever more deeply into states of distrust. Yet these states always proved to be rooted in the process of creating a new and larger analytical container, for example, for incest violations by other family members, abuses which, at the time when these would arise, she always feared, I believe, never occurred. For the patient, dealing with her persecutory doubts was awful, an extremely difficult process. But that's how it happened. As these further states came up, they brought in more material about abuse, deeper levels of abuse, earlier levels of abuse, always the paranoid feelings that I would not believe them, always the induced reactions in me that they really didn't happen to her, that cycle going over and over again until this material gradually all came into the analytic process in that way. My patient suffered terribly when her heart connection and mine with her was absent. The loss of heart was the main abandonment issue in our work, as it had always been in her life. Harry Guntrip refers to the lost heart of the self in the schizoid personality. And this metaphor well describes the schizoid quality in all of us. What was remarkable about the process of unions and ensuing Negredo states was that this process continually integrated the heart while diminishing her schizoid withdrawal. Jung quotes the alchemical maxim, take the foul deposit that remains in the cooking vessel and preserve it, for it is the crown of the heart. Take the foul deposit that remains in the cooking vessel and preserve it, for it is the crown of the heart. I believe that we had implicitly followed this saying. The foul deposit of the pain and grief of our interactions, especially those which denied the absence of relationship and sought to force some connection, and those in which psychotic levels of transference and countertransference dominated, could become the crown upon which a new heart connection could grow. Thank you. Let's take a break, and then we can have some questions. About 10 minutes. Okay. Does anybody have a question or comment? Yes. Well, we're born split. We are all born split. It's the only way to be born. We all at birth, I think, are really follow that ancient notion of the child being a child of God, in which the child really does know that other realm. You know, that's a belief of mine, and I don't think it's a metaphor either. I think it's a belief that is about perception. But as the child begins to have to enter space-time world and integrate body perceptions and forms that are finite, there has to be a loss. But part of the soul seems to always stay in search of that light. So in that sense, we're always split. There really is, in reality, absolutely no difference. Absolutely no difference. My experience from what I know about women therapists is that women have a real ease with this intense level of union states with another woman, far easier than men do with men. But that's just because of homophobia. But if that's not an issue, and as it ceases to be an issue, the states between men and men and women, as far as I know, don't differ that substantially. See, in that subtle body realm. Well, two women two men will all have, you know, different forms of an underlying imaginal couple ruling their interaction. Two men will have often similar forms as two women, a sadomasochistic form. I think that you see, that we haven't had, there isn't too much written yet, by me anyways, or others, about the male conjunctio. It's mostly written about in terms of men and women, because that's the model. The model's tantric. So the model comes from male and female model. I give you one example. I was working with a man who came to me after being away, being in another training program for a while, became a finished analyst, and wanted to, but had some problems, some unfinished business, and wanted to work with me on that business. And he came from a long way away, came every week, and he came for 2 years. And it was clear that a lot more material had opened up along the way, but he had really dealt with what he wanted to. He had really dealt with the material he had come to deal with. And while he had enormous expectancy that I would resist his ending, because there was so obviously so much more to deal with, I didn't, and I respected his desire to stop. And that night, he had the following dream. He dreamed that he was starting to enter me sexually. I encouraged him to put his penis into me. I had a vagina. He then got kind of scared, feared homosexual things. So he withdrew his penis. But when he looked down, he saw that his penis was covered with gold. It's a kind of wonderful image for him, a wonderful image for him, really, really special. And that was an image of a conjunctio happening in the unconscious, that moment, between two men. I could give you other examples too. But it's true that most of my clinical stuff is with women because I guess I get more erotically charged with a woman. And that's a big part of the conjunctio field. So more of my examples come that way. Yeah. Yes, I saw her face to face, and I unfortunately couldn't see her that often. I only saw her three times a week. And at this kind of level, you need five or six. You really do. And it was a great strain on her that it was less. I saw her three times a week. Yeah. Well, I can't be sure. The question was, what effect did she have on her patients? Well, I can tell you this much. She now runs a group for incest survivors. She has become, I know she's a good therapist in the sense of really keeping a caseload and has grown and grown and grown. So at least certainly, and has become, and it was a surprise to me to find out that she just told me about the incest group she had started. Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, she was a therapist for 20 years before she came to me. No. The psychotic part of her, you see, you know, was what erupted in our sessions. Before she came to me, she basically functioned with a rather obsessive-compulsive personality. When she came to me, that personality structure broke down sufficiently and the psychotic material emerged. When that happened, it was very difficult at times for her to do therapy. It definitely did make therapy very stressful for her. But that was during a confined period of time that we were working through this material, probably for, I would say, maybe for a two-year period. But she could manage. And she could also be, you know, extremely, as a result of being in touch with her own madness, could reach those levels in her patient. It was stressful, but she's not a psychotic person. It was just a question of touching those areas in herself, and the fact was that she always had a sufficient degree of containment in her work with me. At times it felt marginal, but she was able to go on with her patients. There were a few weeks that she had to stop working. There were a few weeks, but basically she could get through. Hard. Yes? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The question was if the union state precedes the negredo in cases that are not based on sexual abuse. Definitely. See, the sexual abuse issue kind of brings that to the fore more fully, because anybody who has been violated, you know, of course, is very close to the archetypal level and to those powerful energies. And when that conjunctio or union state is at all touched, then those energies tend to rush in and the negredo state gets very energized. But that is an archetypal pattern for someone who is not an incest victim as well. With someone who has not, you know, been violated, if that conjunctio does occur, my belief is it always is followed by a negredo. Now, it's quite remarkable how that can often not be seen.
remember for example, a therapist who work I was supervising, you know, was telling me about this, you know, all the signs of this kind of conjunctive experience, and then said that, but there was no, just didn't feel any negreta or anything like that that followed, except in everything the patient was saying, she was talking about nothing but feeling disconnected, feeling not linked, but was putting it all on an outer situation. The fact was that she was displacing it, but he wasn't able to bring it into the therapy. She was talking about it really with him. So it's not that that negredo state will necessarily land itself right in the therapy hour. It'll itself often be subject to splitting defenses that the therapist has to be able to see through and bring it back into the therapy hour. But I've never seen an instance where that pattern didn't follow. Yes? Oh, yes, I told her. Yes, of course. I mean, I acknowledged that to her. I did not just keep that to myself. I acknowledged that her perception...
'11-1789, C.G. Jung Society, Alchemy Lecture, Side 1.
On behalf of the board of the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, I want to welcome you all here tonight. My name is Celia Hartley, and I'm the president of the society. We are very pleased to have Dr. Nathan Swartzeland in Seattle again. It was our pleasure to have him here in the fall of 1986. Near as we can remember, that's when it was. It wasn't too long ago. Dr. Swartzeland, as I know most all of you know, is a Jungian analyst practicing in New York City and Princeton, New Jersey. He is the author of Narcissism and Character Transformation and the recently published The Borderline Personality, Vision, and Healing. He is also co-editor of the Chiron Clinical Series. Dr. Swartzeland is also director of the Salant Foundation in Princeton, New Jersey, which is dedicated to research in Jungian psychology. Tomorrow, Dr. Swartzeland will be conducting a seminar beginning at 10 a.m. The seminar will be held at Cornish North, the brick building to the north of St. Mark's Cathedral on 10th Avenue East. We hope that those of you who have not already signed up will plan to attend. The green sheet out on the table will give you more information about time and directions. And now it is my pleasure to welcome and to present to you all Dr. Swartzeland.
Can you hear me? Okay. Please tell me to speak up if it's not loud enough. It's a little hard for me to talk. This is 10:30 my time, New York time, and analysts should be embodied, you know, but it's very difficult to remain embodied when you're tired. I'll do my best. Also, do interrupt any time you want and ask questions. But I'll go along and try to judge when we should have a break. And I'll try to keep things within an arena of about an hour, give or take a few minutes, depending on how slowly I can manage to talk. And then leave time for questions. The soul, wrote C.G. Jung, is the living thing in man that which lives of itself and causes life. Now, what has been the fate of this essentially human reality in the life of an individual? Is that not the question that all analysts face when meeting a patient? What has become of this person's soul? How has an authentic inner life been aided or desecrated by the relations it has or has not known? This inner life has, in all who come to see us, become split up into fragments, some of which still contain a holy spark, consonant with that age-old notion that the child is a child of God. All too frequently, these sparks of an authentic soul are hidden within an inner madness. That's really what I'm going to be talking to you about tonight, is madness. The soul thus speaks in voices of delusional hope and bottomless despair. It cries in intense rage and shudders with a fear that few people will embrace. The basic feelings common to this state of abandonment comprise a profound sense of emptiness and, as an aspect of estrangement, a sense of meaninglessness of the external world. And yet the truth that a soul did once exist and still can exist drives people to analysts who in turn must ask the crucial question. What is this person's story? And what has been the fate of his or her soul? And the simultaneous question, how does this person's story and mine interweave? For the analyst is changed by the analysis of a patient, if it is a deep analysis at all. Now, when a person's split-off soul is finally contacted in analysis in a containing way, one meets a very difficult and demanding situation. This part can only live in the world and the body if its perceptions are validated. This seems like a simple thing, but it's very far from the case. For the perceptions of this part are generally felt as excruciatingly painful to the analyst. A patient's split-off soul sees the slightest movement away from contact. The analyst tends to want a break, to not have to be perfect. The patient all the while is inwardly experiencing being attacked for being too much, wanting too much, being unreasonable, too exacting, too rageful, too much for anyone to be with. The patient's perceptions to a normal workaday consciousness are far too demanding. But to the split-off part, it is only the truth that is wanted, a true contact that is devastated by the slightest iota of falseness. That is the terrifying dilemma the soul faces here, and that's why these parts rarely enter an analytic process. The object can be quite good, quite empathic and open to seeing his or her errors. Yet even in this openness and deep searching, the slightest miscue, self-reference, or failure to grasp a metaphorical meaning of a story that the patient tells will be felt to the patient as killing. The patient is then in the impossible dilemma. If I speak, I'll be killed. That is, my perceptions will not be acknowledged in a fully truthful way. And if I don't speak, I'll be killed. That is, by my own rage and hatred. The patient is left in a terrible despair and can do very little by his or her own efforts alone.
Rather, a hidden mystery of true perception and heartfelt contact must be opened. But how?
In other words, I'm trying to talk to you tonight about parts of the psyche that very commonly and most usually in the course of an analysis do not get analyzed. Parts of the psyche that are usually called schizoid. What one is up against in the process of analysis, you see, is not just the issue of these very split-off parts intruding in one way or another into the analysis, but the question is, how are these parts, which I've called the split-off soul, ever to come into the analytic process in a way that's containing and stable, so that there is a continuity in dealing with them over time? That's the difficult issue, and that's the issue that I think the apparatus of Jungian psychology has a great deal to offer. And so I want to give you, if you can bear with it, I like to do this in the beginning of the lecture while you're still alert, a few more theoretical ideas, and then the body of what I want to say to you will be a long case history. Now, it's an axiom of Jungian thought that the life of the soul is cast between two qualities of existence, one historical and the other mythical. Its fate is strongly dependent upon pre-existing potential forms of order, the archetypes, and their far larger scale than life in the discreteness of the space-time world of the ego. I wouldn't talk about archetypes if I wasn't going to bring you clinical material which shows you what I mean about the reality of these issues for the here and now of work. But for now, I want to cast for you that these two realities are different and also always inextricably intertwined. In analysis, these larger patterns, what Jung called archetypes, often make their presence known in a subtle background manner, weaving the story of the fate of the soul. Discovering the story in terms of historical antecedents alone is never fully satisfying. It explains causes but yields no meaning. Yet without historical reconstruction, an archetypal grasp alone will easily fall prey to lies and deception. Truth has always been known to be the result that falls out of a combination of the two realms, temporal and atemporal, time-bound, historical, and archetypal. We find this ancient wisdom in the two matrices that underpin the structure of the I Ching. In Blake's idea of the divine Jesus in particularity, in Beyond's notion of binocular vision, and in the Jungian duality of personal and archetypal. Analysis must constantly reflect between the two realms, and in the process discover a story, the story of the patient's soul, but also a particular tale of the analysis, the story that both people create and discover. Like the biblical notion of self, this story is an unfinished and unfinishable poem. Not an unfolding of a system carrying inner secrets and structures to be revealed. Now, my goal in this paper is to demonstrate the interweaving of the archetypal and personal, historical and mythical levels of human existence. Jung spoke of this difference at one point in terms of a person having two souls, one concerning personal existence since birth
and the other soul ancestral, reaching deeply into the ancient history of humankind. To explore these qualities of soul and its distress through abandonment and persecutory despair, Jung employed an historical method of amplification. So consider for a moment how certain people, in this case the alchemists, some 400 years ago, conceived of the soul's dark night of soul loss. In particular, let's look to Jung's notion of the alchemical nigredo. Now you see, the point is this. He believed that the only way you can properly get a sense of an existing historical situation is by getting to a point far outside of your history and seeing it. In the case of our present epoch, we deal with what we have now, this thing called ego consciousness. We had very little of it up to a few hundred years ago. We seem to be getting too much of it now. We have the capacity to have an ego, to have a self-same identity that doesn't slip away every time the moon changes phases. We have the capacity to have a state of stability that coheres and inheres in our life, in time and space, from day to day. We get up in the morning and we are the same kind of person, more or less, than we were yesterday, and can attend to tasks in time and space. This was not something that humankind always had. In fact, the word for consciousness, self-awareness, only came into language, in the German language, in the 18th century. You deal with, in fact, a new creation, this ego and ego consciousness. One may see the seeds of it in mythical forms in mythology hundreds and hundreds of years ago, but the thing itself has only come into being over the last few hundred years, sometimes thought of as with Descartes, as being the entrance of this into history. Now, when you have this kind of an observing tool, an ego, you also are desperately in danger of seeing the trees and not the forest. You're in danger of not seeing the larger picture. Previous cultures, previous forms of consciousness were far more aware of the subtle background forms of existence. They suffered from a lack of ego. They suffered from a lack of the capacity to have an objectivity. But they did not suffer from what we suffer from now, which is the inability to recognize a fundamental oneness of existence to everything, and instead we get stuck in the parts of things. So Jung found it very necessary to go back to times far earlier in history, to ancient cultures, and particularly he spent a great deal of time in alchemy, which is going to be what I'll be talking about tomorrow in this workshop. He spent a great deal of time in alchemy as a wonderful example of psychic life that was relatively unfiltered by the critiques and obsessions and vulnerabilities and narcissistic needs of an ego consciousness. That's the reason for getting outside of one's historical epoch to look at something. Not to deny the extreme importance of what we can learn from developmental processes as was never known in earlier times. Not to deny the incredible advances that we have made in terms of object relations and ego psychology and all of that. That's vital. But to get outside of it and get a different vantage point as well, a vantage point of background structures that organize our existence, not merely to see life as the sum of what's been taken in from the environment. Psyche is not a sum of introjected processes that have come to pass from early infant development, processes that have been worked over perhaps by ambivalence or whatever. Psyche is also an autonomous quality that has archetypal contents built into it that are a priori to individual object relations. That's Jung's point of view. See,
And it's for this reason that we want to look at phenomena from another point of view other than the smallness of the clinical situation, other than the tyranny of object relations, the tyranny of developmental schemas in which you can fit anything. But as I said before, whatever we do in the larger mythical realm, if we don't find a way to see that those patterns fit developmental issues, it's pie in the sky. It's fantasy. It's fantastic imagination. It's not real. For those of you who might have some background in science, science is cast in terms of equations. When someone solves an equation, you have what's called a general solution. Any particular problem, however, has its own particular qualities that science calls boundary conditions or initial conditions. The general solution is like the archetypal patterns. The boundary conditions are the particularity of historical life that are often only grasped well in terms of developmental theories. Those two have to be combined. Those two have to be combined if we approach some sense of truth in the analytic situation. Because what we're after, what I'm trying to be after here, is an analysis that will engage those split off parts of soul, not an analysis that'll only be more and more power in service of the demonic lying that exists in all of us, the lie that will continually split it off and not engage it. That's the dilemma we face. Anything that we give to the patient can be used as a lie. Anything can be used to lie. That's the problem. Now, in Jung's investigations of alchemy, he tells us that the Negredo brought about a deformation and a psychic suffering which compares to the plight of the unfortunate Job. Jung refers to the alchemical writer Olympiodorus on the pain, struggle, and violence of the Negredo and quotes him saying, "All the while a demon instills negligence, impeding our intentions. Everywhere this demon creeps about, both within and without, causing oversights, anxiety, and unexpected accidents." And the philosopher Patacio says, "So bedeviled and shameless is the lead that all who wish to investigate it fall into madness through ignorance." Now, if the alchemists are correct, investigating the depths of the difficult experiences associated with abandonment will bring about levels of psychotic transference and countertransference. Ignorance seems to rear its head anew in each case. Now, Jung uncovered the importance of archetypes in analysis by observing psychotic states of mind, by observing schizophrenics, in fact. Now, here's the point that really is the core of what I want to bring to you today and explain to you with clinical material. I believe that we can most fully experience the inherent rhythm of personal and archetypal levels when we have opened ourselves to those states of mind within us in which the self does not function in a containing way, and in which we are in danger of being overwhelmed. When rooted in these levels, we are at least potentially psychotic. Symptoms of such behavior would be losing a symbolic capacity, being driven by persecutory anxieties, distorting reality, and being unable to differentiate inner from outer. Now, I use the term psychotic advisedly. I'm saying that there is, and I'm not, of course, original in this in the least, but it is not that popular in a point of view, even in psychoanalytic tradition yet,
namely that everybody has an inner madness, has a normal side and a psychotic twin, to use Beyond's form. Every single one of you here has a madness in you. But it's a madness that's encapsulated for most of you and doesn't reach your conscious perceptions, so you don't know that it's going on. But if you're with the patient, and if that patient, for example, happens to be a borderline patient, to give you an intense example, then what will happen is that that patient's psyche will impact upon you. And you will, at one time or another, find yourself in a place where you're in great danger of being overwhelmed. Your defenses may rally, and you may find great comfort in diagnosing your patient as borderline. But the fact is, you will touch a level in yourself where you will be in danger of being overwhelmed. And you may not, like an overtly psychotic person, distort outer reality, but you will distort your patient's reality. When your patient speaks of despair, you will sidestep it and give a solution for that despair. When your patient speaks of intense rage and hatred, you will sidestep it and think about people in his or her environment that is hated rather than you. All along, you will tend to distort, and the distortions will come out of that part of you that is in great danger of being overwhelmed. And that is the psychotic part. And what I'm bringing to you tonight is the point of view that that part must be actively engaged by the analyst if his notions of personal and archetypal are to have a living reality in the analytic process. When I speak about psychotic levels or madness, I want to emphasize the existence of these areas in everyone. As Lacan said, not only can man's being not be understood without madness, it would not be man's being if it did not bear madness within itself as the limit of his freedom. Madness as the limit of his freedom. While the rhythm of personal and archetypal levels can be known from a positive self-connection, it can be known from being in a perfectly centered space, from being in Tao, while it can be known that way, of course, knowing this linking through experiencing the limit of our freedom as we're driven there by our patients has a particular healing potential. When you are driven into that corner of your psyche in which you are in grave danger of being overwhelmed, when your defenses are shattered, when you're quick to go into a manic mood, when you're quick to split, when you're quick to idealize, when you're quick to intellectualize, when you do everything but stay in your body and feel, that's where your freedom is hounded out of existence. That's where you're not free. And that's what Lacan is talking about. And it's that area, that boundary, that's the critical boundary that we have to touch upon. That's the boundary that, for example, in mythologies is often seen as encircling the world as a serpent. In Egyptian myth, there's a boundary of the known world. And that known world has a serpent on one edge, and beyond it is chaos. Beyond it is the primeval waters. The primeval waters of chaos, out of which emerged structure, out of which emerged in an Egyptian myth in a pyramid text from about ancient kingdom, 4,000 BC, about 4,500 years ago, 2,500 BC. An ancient text says, I am the great world egg whose head came out of the waters, while doing was still in a time of confusion, while doing was still asleep.
structure coming up before any doing is known at all. In that realm of waters, in that realm of chaos, where up and down are not known, and any of you who have been in psychotic states, you know that that's what they're talking about, where there's no left and right, up and down, everything is massive confusion, no light, the waters haven't separated, there's just darkness. It's in that place that every single culture on Earth has known one has to return for healing. In those waters in which one can get lost in an irrevocable madness. Yet in those waters are the waters of healing, and we, in our own little way, can touch them in psychotherapy through our own connection to our own madness, in the way I've talked about it, without defending against it and seeing instead the patient's madness. Now, alchemy maintains that this dark state, this dark negredo, this state of madness, this is important, follows upon what they call a conjunctio. And it's important to emphasize that this conjunctio, a union state, often precedes the dark and dangerous affects of the abandonment depression as it is encountered in analysis. This will be a major theme in the clinical material. It's not just a question of somebody being in a chaotic, crazy place. It's how you get into it that matters. It's the way one gets into it that matters. The alchemical model insists that it follows, in fact, upon a state of intense union. If we do not know this, we may be too prone to seeing such states of mind as mere replays of infant experience. See these terribly disordered states as just replays of early experience, while in fact they may be part of a new creation. They may be part of experiences that have never before been conscious. The union state may be imaginally experienced during the here and now of analytical work, and I've written about this a lot, where one can experience this conjunctio as a third thing, as a state between two people that draws them together and separates them apart. It can be experienced that way. But it also can elude our perception, and as Jung said, be discovered only later, retrospectively, through a series of dreams. Now, it's going to be this kind of union state that my clinical material tonight is going to refer to. Not a state that ever was conscious in the room between us, but rather states that could be inferred from the patient's dream material to have preceded the dark states that we found ourselves in. It should be emphasized that union, what the alchemists called the conjunctio, is not merely a process where contents of the analyst's and patient's unconscious connect and combine. Instead, energy is released through that experience. There's a release of energy in what they mean by the conjunctio. It's not just merging. This, of course, is the archetypal process that underlies the passionate desire in science for achieving fusion states. You see, one can release energy in different ways. You can release it through splitting. Splitting releases a great deal of energy, tremendous energy in manic states of mind, for example. So you can split the atom and release energy. That was the first way it happened. Fusion states have not been achieved yet, apparently. Fusion is another way. The alchemical quest was passionately for the conjunctio, you see, a positive fusion state. In negative states of unconscious projective identification, or participatio mystique, as Jung calls it, a release of energy occurs that tends toward compulsion and acting out. A positive form of the conjunctio was a fusion state that can be consciously addressed without either person's ego using the released energies for power or defensive purposes. Now, tomorrow I'll talk considerably more about that. I'll talk considerably more about the kinds of interactive fields that are created in the process between patient and analyst. But let me go on now to my clinical material. These ideas I've given you before are a background for me for the way I've handled and related to this material. The following material is drawn from the fourth through the sixth years of my work with a 45-year-old woman patient. During the first 4 years, the theme of incest was hardly mentioned. It had also gone unnoticed in a number of her previous analyses. One of her initial complaints was that her previous therapist told her that he found her spiritually but not sexually attractive. He was honest, right? He was psychotic at that time, but didn't know it. This was a grave injury to her. But there was also something strange in her affect when she spoke about it. She was in a state of mind-body splitting, and she became mentally blank. But what was most significant in retrospect was my willingness to sidestep these dissociated states of mind and instead to focus upon her statement as an injunction to me to not reject her in the same way. After 4 years of analysis, she began recalling memories of being sexually abused when she was 6 years old by an older brother and much earlier by a nursemaid. During this time, centering upon her brother incest trauma, we explored the sadomasochistic nature of her inner life as it expressed itself in brutal self-attacks for what she took to be her role in the incest episode, and then even harsher attacks that she had made it all up and was really crazy. As this theme of incest gradually became more central to our work, I found myself internally resisting that it could really have happened to her. She then began a session with a question. What do I do with my feelings when I feel no connection with you? What do I do with my feelings when I feel no connection with you? The affect field that accompanied the posing of this question was so charged with hostile and accusatory challenge, leading to confusion in me, that what I thought she said was, "What has happened to our connection?" I felt challenged and angry. I was bewildered by the strength of my reaction, but I mostly sidestepped it and focused upon a sense of being irritated with her. I know none of you have had similar experiences. I took this feeling, along with my tendency, along with my tendency to dismiss her question as unimportant, as representing an induced reaction to her masochism. Clever, huh? I challenged her by insisting that there was a connection between us, just that it was on a sadomasochistic level. And I focused the session on exploring these dynamics as they were developing within projective identification. It's not for nothing that in the Middle Ages, science was thought to come from the devil. I thought a good deal had been accomplished, but the result was the emergence of a psychotic transference. In subsequent sessions, the patient was blank, withdrawn, and terrified. When I said something to her, she took it in a very concrete way, believing that I hated her and had said so. For example, at one point in the previous session, while engaged in what I took to be her fantasy life, experienced through projective identification, you know, when a patient, so to speak, puts parts of his or her personality into you, projective identification, believing that I was dealing with projective identification, I said, "You expect me to hate you and find you a disgusting whore." My language was her own, derived from the many previous sessions in which we had dealt with her self-attack stemming from memories of her brother's sexual abuse of her. I had come to believe that by now she knew she was an incest victim. But this knowledge, I was soon to learn, had at best been assimilated by her normal neurotic ego, and not at all by her psychotic parts. With the interactive field between us enlivened, I believed I experienced the patient's sadomasochistic couple, in which her inner sadist was blaming her for the incest and, in effect, accusing her of being a whore. I thought I was bringing this dynamic out and into consciousness by giving it voice. The patient, largely through my blunder, thus entered into her psychotic part, but with a certain degree of containment. She was filled with distrust and terror of me, yet she also knew that she had to work things out with me. An alliance did exist. Psychotic transference, but not a delusional transference. The alliance still existed. Now, she had written up the session which began with her question about feelings and her connection to me and her belief that I had said that I had hated her. At this point, I was now committed to helping her more normal ego qualities recognize the distortions of her psychotic part. I was looking at her, not my or our madness, and trying to help her sort out reality. When we finally went back to her initial question, I recalled it as I had heard it, and told her that I felt angered by her question, which I experienced as an attack upon our work. I thus had looked for where we really did have a connection, and this, I could see, was surely a hostile act on my part. Only after this kind of exploration, in which I began to reflect upon the validity of her perceptions, did she find some relief. Now there was an analytic space in which she could again begin to work on her incest issues, and her psychotic qualities, which had been manifesting as extreme splitting, withdrawal, reality distortion, and intense and dangerous suicidal drives. I believe that if we are to engage the potential available to us in fostering the integration of a patient's psychotic part, rather than fortify his or her normal neurotic ego, it is necessary to find a way to acknowledge the truth of the patient's perceptions, which stem from the psychotic sector, even if those perceptions carry considerable distortion with them. The patient's perceptions must be validated, must be seen to carry truth, if indeed truth they do carry. The reality distortions that stem from the psychotic part would appear to make the act of acknowledging the truth of the patient's perceptions quite hazardous. Such a procedure, it would seem, could be used by the patient to further reify his or her distortions. My experience is that this concern usually does not prove to be problematic. But there's one reason, fundamental reason, to be wary of it. Such openness by the analyst can be a hidden way of seducing the patient into taking care of the analyst's feelings. That is certainly its shadow side, and it has to be analyzed in later material that will appear. But unless we find a way to mirror the accuracy of the soul's vision, we shall rarely succeed in helping the patient to integrate the depth of his or her being, the depth of being that is trapped in psychotic distortions. In a following session, she said, "I cannot trust anyone. I'm in a cold, withdrawn place, and I am terrified of the power you have over me. If I tell you anything of what I thought last night, you can annihilate me in an instant. I have never before felt the total power you have over me, and it terrifies me. I just want to withdraw and totally leave everything. This process, life." Her terror at this point now centered upon what I had said when we went over the session. For I told her that she heard me say that she was a disgusting whore. I explained that I didn't believe this, but I believed I was playing out a fantasy with her, a process I thought she was aware of while it was going on. She listened intently, and I thought I was making progress in helping her to see her reality distortion. In the next session, I learned that it wasn't the whore part that got to her, but rather that I said that she had heard me say what I did, implying to her that I had not said it at all and that she was quite mad. She felt her perceptions were annihilated by me, and she was left not knowing what to believe or trust. She was especially terrified by the possibility that I thought she was crazy. She felt that now I was just soothing her and lying to her. As I again explained that I actually did say what she believed I said, but that she took it in the wrong way, it was becoming clear, even to me, in my absurd attack on the psychotic elements between us, that I was having little effect. I then asked myself, where is she correct? She believed I said what I did because I really felt she was a disgusting whore, but was now denying this feeling. This belief could stem from her psychosis, or it could be a result of a trickster-like force dominating our process. Or was her belief rooted in a perception of my own mad parts, with which I have had, when with this patient, too little awareness? It is clear that at times I did distort what she said, as when I did not accurately hear and process her question concerning what should she do with her feelings when she felt no connection to me. When I insisted that only a change of form in the connection had occurred, I denied her perceptions and what she experienced, namely a space in which she had absolutely no link with me or with herself. After another session, feeling the stress of my work with her, I recorded the following imaginal process, my imagination.
I want to thrash her, drown her in a stormy sea, throw her body to and fro in the waves until she will stop this torture of me with her withdrawals and masochism, leaving me always the guilty party. I feel the edges of losing the as if. Did I do it or didn't I? I then recognized that unconsciously I may have felt this identification for some time, namely that I was her older brother, the one who had incestuously violated her. As a consequence of denying this level of psychotic countertransference, this level in which there was no as if, in which I touched a core of myself in which I was him. As a consequence of denying that, however, I had been forcing interpretations while trying to feel empathic and related to her, rather than feeling the air of unreality and disconnection which actually pervaded our work. Now, after these attempts at sorting out our process together, she asked the inevitable question, does this mean that I have been putting these reactions into you? Unfortunately for her, she's a therapist, you see, so she knows all these gimmicks. Therapists really can do a job on themselves. So she asked, does this mean that I have been putting these reactions into you? How easy it would have been to say yes. Clearly something like this had been going on, but I also felt that in becoming aware of the psychotic countertransference, I was opening up to a much larger realm that seemed to have a goal or a purpose. In other words, just touching that realm of awareness in which I believed I was her brother, I also touched a sense of a different scale, a different largeness of psyche in me that I knew was really at work in this process. Now, while the domain that I engaged with her surely included incest fantasies with my own mother and sister, the experience of a larger domain, an interactive field between us, and the sense that we were going through a process together, a process determined by this interactive field, offered a sense of meaning. This was no doubt an area in need of exploration, yet it soon began to feel too mental and non-substantial. And so I turned back to a projective identification, a developmental, historical view of parts I put into her and she into me. And in turn, this felt too small, a killing of a realm of meaning. And in this way, an emergence of the awareness of an oscillation between a personal, historical, and mythical, archetypal level resulted. This awareness had a changing form along lines of differing consciousness, mythical and historical. But what I want to emphasize is by interacting with my own psychotic countertransference, it was possible to actually penetrate.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.